This is Frank Coletta, and you are listening to Gangland Wire. And if you're ever in Vegas, take the Frank Coletta Casino Tour, 702-622-0850. Thank you.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jinx Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, hello, all you wiretappers out there. We're here in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Tonight, folks, we have a special guest calling in from New York City. But first, before I introduce him, I want to say one thing to one of our fans out there. I got a letter from a guy, Dr. Jim Burkhart, who said, I love your podcast. He's a local chiropractor. Dr. Jim Burkhart, thanks a lot for your letter and your kind words about our podcast. We try. And folks, there started a Reddit string out there, so go to Reddit if you're a Reddit person and just search for Gangland Wire and start entering in a discussion about the podcast on Reddit. So having said all that, a little self-promotion and get people involved in the conversation that we have on my Facebook page too, Gangland Wire and the Reddit string. We have Kenji Gallo. Kenji, it's really great to have you here tonight.
I'm glad to be here.
You know, Kenji, we first met at the first, I believe it was the first MobCon in 2013. You and Ron Fino, who I need to get on here, he has a book. And we had Frank Calabrese, and we recorded Andrew DiDonato. And so you're the final one, not the final one. I got to get Ron Fino on here. And that was quite a MobCon. We're putting another one together. Denny Griffin's not going to be involved. He's not out there in Las Vegas all the time like he once was, but there's another guy who's putting one together. I'm going to go out and participate. We'd be happy to have you if you, of course, there's no money to pay anybody to come out, but we'd be happy to have you if you wanted to be in Las Vegas on June the 15th to the 17th this summer.
Well, we'll check. I'll see if my schedule will permit it. We'll see.
You know, you should tell me. I believe maybe there's one of that New Japan Wrestling that weekend.
Oh yeah, what was that deal?
There's a guy I know who just signed a deal to fight for the New Japan Wrestling, and he said, "I said Gary had texted me going, hey, can you go out to Vegas this weekend?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I can." And then I mentioned it to this guy. He's a young guy, and he signed with these guys to fight for him, and he said, oh, well, I'm going to be in Vegas that weekend fighting for New Japan.
Well, we can go see a wrestling match that week. Is that wrestling or mixed martial arts? Now, Kenji here is a mixed martial arts dude.
Yeah.
What is it? Is this wrestling?
I think it's wrestling. It's wrestling.
Okay, I've never heard. Have you heard of that, Kenji? New Japan wrestling?
Yeah, I've heard of it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I know what it is, yeah.
It's not quite the same as mixed martial arts, full contact fighting, is it?
No, but it's pretty good wrestling. They do a real good show. They do it all over Japan. They're pretty big.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, Kenji, you have quite a story. Going back to being raised in Orange County, California, as a young man from a upper middle class family, I believe. Let's start at the beginning here. Start a little bit about your childhood and bring it forward pretty quickly to how you got to where you went, actually entered into a life of crime.
Well, I mean, like you said, I grew up in Orange County, California. I grew up in Irvine, California, and mostly South Orange County. So Irvine, Newport Beach, Costa Mesa, those are like my Corona Del Mar, my areas. I went to school there. I went to a military school for a while, and then I came back. And, I mean, I grew up normal. My dad was a publisher, and he at one point worked for TV Guide, and he did the art for them. And, I was just different. I wanted some excitement. I wanted to be in crime. And I just, looked up to those guys. Anyway, my dad got me a job at a restaurant in Orange County, and I remember the first day, I'm sitting outside. I took two buses to get there. I'm sitting outside, and the guy pulls up, and it's a guy named Joe Avila. And he pulls up, and he gets out of his Cadillac, and he's got, like, the gold Rolex, the gold chain, the silk shirt, the slacks, the polished shoes. I mean, this is early, you know, early 1980s, not even mid-80s yet. I was like, wow. I mean, he just gets out, and then I was working at his restaurant. He had opened a Japanese restaurant. I started working there. I worked there before they even opened, and I was going to be kitchen help and busboy, so I was cutting stuff. And I quickly realized that every single person that came in there was pretty much a big-time criminal. I mean, Joe had been arrested in 1977 with his brothers. He was a mastermind of a thing called the Tahitian Connection, where they brought cocaine from Colombia and Peru to Hawaii, to Tahiti, and then to Hawaii. They actually had F. Lee Bailey represent them, and they got off on the charges. I quickly started meeting all the people there, and I met people that would eventually be part of the Medellin cartel. I met a lady there named Griselda Trujillo Blanco. They made a movie, a couple documentaries about her. They call her the Black Widow. They call her Blanco. I always knew we called her Mama Coca. So, you know, and then she became famous with her son. She's been gunned down. Almost all her sons have been killed except for two. And she has one little son, young son, named Michael Sepulveda Corleone. I fell right into the drug trafficking with those guys. I used to be a mule for them. I started being like a little baby kingpin because I was, during high school, I was able to get quarter pounds and above of cocaine. This is in the 80s when a kilo of cocaine was worth like $30,000 to $45,000 in Newport wholesale. And we'd sell it. And my senior year in high school, I graduated high school. And the next day I was on a plane to Hawaii with kilos of cocaine in my carry-on baggage.
Wow.
I used to make the flight to Hawaii, drop it off, pick up, you know, a couple $100,000 sometimes, come right back. I used to go to a travel agency back then, buy my ticket in cash, buy a round-trip ticket, and then on one airline, and then another return round-trip ticket on another airline for the next day. So I would leave and go there and then come back the next day, and then I just throw away the other two tickets. And back then, remember, you didn't have to have an ID to get on a plane.
Right.
So you could buy them from anywhere. So I used to just make up names. And then I quickly learned, you know, how to get fake IDs, and I had many, multiple IDs. And I fell in with those guys, and I just moved up. And by the time I was, you know, 19, I was already selling, you know, 10, 20 kilos at a time. I would get I could sell easily 50 a month.
That was just the beginning of your life.
Right. And this was in high school?
Right. This was in high school. Wow.
Right after high school, yeah.
I want to say that, folks, so, you can already tell this is a heck of a story. And he has a book out there. It's called Break Shot, A Life in the 21st Century Mafia. And let me read you just a little bit of one review, and you'll understand a little more about what he's going to start talking about. I want you guys to get a feel for our friend here, the life he's led, to get into it. Breakshot is one of the most entertaining crime nonfiction books I've read. Reads like a true life Grand Theft Auto game come to life. Kenny Gallo is a Gen Xer Asian American thug from Los Angeles who somehow survives the cocaine wars of the 80s, becomes a porn producer, and then at the end becomes a New York City mafia associate. He has a unique storytelling ability that is both funny and scary at the same time. Gallo never sugarcoats his story or makes himself appear to be more important than he really is. Usually the shortcoming of mafia books, see Henry Hill and Wise Guy. So, folks, first of all, you got to get this book. And he's going to talk a lot more about some of the things in the book over the next hour or so. It's a heck of a story. I've read it, and it is one heck of a story. Tell me a little bit about that cocaine. Now, I was, as you know, I was a policeman in the 80s, and I was on the other end in Kansas City. And when the L.A. boys first came to Kansas City, they already had set up with connections with probably people like you, or these were the street gang people, or a lot of them, they were dealing directly with the Colombians, and the dope was just flowing into Los Angeles in the 80s and on up into the 90s. Kind of, how did that work?
Well, what happened originally was the Colombians brought it into Miami, and then the government cracked down on the Miami. They really, because it was the shortest point for planes from Colombia, and then Carlos Letter and the Medellin cartel were flooding it, but they started flooding through California with a guy named Gacha Rodriguez. the people I was connected with were close to Gotye Rodriguez and the Ochoa brothers. What they did is they started bringing cocaine up through Mexico. And Joe and those guys, uncle was the head of the Mexican Federal Police in one of the states. And so he would allow planes to land. And we just had an unlimited supply. I mean, I know one of my Colombian friends that worked for the Medellin cartel got caught selling 1,000 kilos to the FBI. He was going to drop off 2,000. He didn't have a truck big enough to bring them.
Wow.
They had to arrest him. They couldn't let him walk and then come back with the next one. I mean, this guy was a really close friend of mine too. That's what we were doing then. And then back then, that's when I first started meeting some of the LCN guys. Cosa Nostra is around there, because of course they're attracted to money. So they would be around the club. I would meet these guys, and everyone like held them in awe, because there's like, you're a criminal, you're a doper, you're a smuggler, whatever you are, you're a thief. But I mean, the top of the heap in the crime world, it's still the LCN guys. It's those guys that organize. Because if you look at all the other crime groups, you lop off the head. Like, as soon as the cartels were, like Pablo Escobar was gone, the Ochoas were gone, that was the end of the Medellin cartel. I mean, you know, it's like every one of these. It's just like everyone's like, oh, you know, like right now, the Mexican cartels, they'll be gone. Like, when the leader is killed and that's the end of them. But the Cosa Nostra keeps going because it's set up like a military. It's set up in rank. So my high school yearbook was to be part of the New York mob. That was my life's dream. I met someone in a man who was a capo in the LA family in 89, named Vincent Dominic Cacci, Jimmy Cacci. And I became close with him. Even when he went to prison, we kept in contact, and I used to keep in contact with his brother. He used to tell me, like, all the time back then, hey, you know, you need me, just give me a call. And, like, you know, and then I became closer to him over the years. Once I realized that the cocaine was dying, I needed to get out. I needed to diversify. So I started, got into sports book and sports, you know, gambling, bookmaking, and loaning out money, shylocking, which is, you know, those are like my two things. That led me to pornography. And once I figured out that you can make these movies for pennies and then flip them for money, I mean, like, I was on that. And I used to get, you know, the Colombians and other people that give me money to make movies, and then I could give them back, you know, a check. So money laundering 101. That's what I did. That's how I got into the porn business. And then the porn business naturally brought me even closer to the Cosa Nostra people, which I needed. Then I used Jimmy and his connections, and I ran into more L.A. guys, Gambino guys, a lot of Colombo guys. And because it was like the Wild West with the cocaine and the porn, and it was a different time. Like, it was just changing. It was changing from film to video. It was just easy because it was kind of like a semi-legitimate business, but, you know, you could still use like, you know, you can't use force on people, and you can't threaten people, and you can't hurt people in like regular business. Like, I couldn't do that in like the jewelry business. Well, you probably could, but not like you could in the porn business. In porn business is, you know, it's wide open. So we started doing that, and I started working for pornographers.
All those gray area businesses are lend themselves to extortion and pressure, and that's why the mob likes to get involved in those things, because there's everybody that's involved. It's already kind of a gray area, whether it may not, like, it's definitely black and white when it comes to dealing big time cocaine, but when it comes to making a sports bet, a bookie takes a few bets, or the porn business, and I can't think of, there's others out there that are kind of in a gray area, and everybody involved is kind of feels like they're doing something wrong, and that's where the mob thrives. That is where they thrive. Do you have something, Aaron?
Oh, I was just kind of curious, as the you say you were shylocking and bookmaking, and that led you into the porn business. That seems kind of a odd transition. Like, we're placing bets on games. I'm giving this guy a loan for a week, and next thing I know, I'm, you know, shooting porn.
Well, no, with me, what it is I gave out big loans, and I was like a Shylock. I would give out money at lower points, and then they would loan it out at higher points. Mm-hmm. So I started meeting more people that made, like, I met a guy, in the business named Peter North. He was a big star in the 80s and early 90s. He wanted to start making movies, so I loaned out money through one of my friends. I loaned out money to him to make two movies, about $60,000. He couldn't sell them. And so I took them back, and then I made a few calls, and I sold them instantly. through my connections. And then I said, wow, let's do this. So I go, let's get him on the hook.
Mm-hmm.
And we started loaning more money to him and then shooting them and selling them. And then we met more people. Because, look, when you're in the shady businesses, you attract other shady business people. Like, those are the kind of people that gamble. Those are the kind of people that borrow money.
Mm-hmm.
A regular businessman, like a legit businessman, is not going to really borrow money from a Shylock. Doesn't need to. Can't repay it anyway. Can't pay back. I need big returns. And they really can't. Like a burglar, a gambler, a drug dealer, those kind of guys, an armed robber, they can pay me back, you know, and pay the points every week. They understand it. A legitimate businessman who's got a wife and kids, that's just a recipe to get thrown in jail, really. I mean, unless you give them a real small loan. So that's how I really got involved in porn. And then I just used my money and stuff to get deeper and deeper in, and then start meeting the girls, meeting the other producers, backing other people. And then that led me to people that needed, that were having problems with other people. And then I got a paycheck out of a business by telling the other people to feed it, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I wormed my way into that kind of.
And of course, it was right at that transition from film to video.
Right. And so it was just super gray area. Like people, like they'd have problems. Like someone would be like knocking off their tapes. And so we'd go take care of it. See, people don't understand, like gambling, it's like fake money. Because I'm not out of product. It's not even like drug dealing. It's like fake money. So like if someone takes, like loses a lot of bets with me or one of my bookies, then they owe us money. It's not real money. I should tell people this, that we're not out anything. So like if he's a dentist, man, get him to do $12,000 worth of work on someone's mouth and then call it even. It's $3,000 worth of work for him and he paid off like a $20,000 debt. I go, who cares? I'm not in the beating up business. We're in the business of making money and it's all fake. So you get your hooks in. I had car dealers. Oh, they owe me $50,000. And I'm like, oh, give me two cars. I'm like, I don't care if they're worth $10,000 total because it's all a profit. It's, you know, if you do your books right, you're making 10% whether they lose, win or lose. Who cares?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's just big. It just grows. And I never like would threaten people unless they were like jeopardizing my business and stuff. Like, you know, other bookies would want to work with me because we always pay no matter what. We always paid.
Well, but
so that's what we have the reputation of doing, and it worked.
I would think that when you do this kind of line of business, though, you would run up against some of these other organized crime elements, you know, a.k.a. the LCN, who are wanting to, you know, own that street.
Yeah, was it in L.A.?
But I was already with.
In L.A.?
I was with the LCN already.
In L.A., was it like in Chicago? In Chicago, they had all the bookmakers lined up, and if you weren't lined up with them, then you were going to find yourself hurt or dead. So in L.A., was it the same way?
It was Jimmy Cacci?
Well, we had Jimmy Cacci. Pete Milano had all the big bookmakers. He was the boss of the family. I mean, we had a lot of there's a lot of independent bookmakers, but L.A. is a way, way more spread out city. Like that area, Southern California, is so much more spread out. But any of the big ones we worked with. And if you didn't, like, if I found out and we wanted money, we would just take it. I mean, we did it. So it was called create and alleviate. So one guy would go and threaten them. We would come in there and say, hey, we can deal with your problem.
I've heard of that before.
I never
heard it called that before, right. But I have heard mob guys doing that before. Create a problem with somebody, and then somebody else comes in and said, you know, I can alleviate your problem. That's pretty tricky. I never heard that terminology before. It's a time-tested mob tactic.
Yeah, and if it doesn't, they just rob them. I mean, what are they going to do? Take their money. I mean, straight out, take them. You bet really, you get really big. You figure out when their pay and owe day is. Follow the guy back and just rob them. Take it from them.
It's not like they can go call the cops.
Just wreck them.
Yeah, they can't call the cops.
Listen, I'm going to call.
And you just took all their money. and if they build it up again, you take it again. It's like free money. Like, you know, just tell everyone, hey. I mean, I threatened a guy one time. I just told him, like, we told him that we were going to kill him if he just didn't give us money. Give us $40,000 without blinking an eye. And I'm like, well, man, we should ask for more. I mean, that was just that life, you know. And so any shady businesses like that, that's how you get in. Like, I got in with the escorts that way. I just, you know, I was there. All the guys that used to do telephone sales, all the phony sales. That's how we even met Kansas City Monsters, phony telephone sales and stuff like that. They all get involved in that. Any of those gray market areas, it's so easy for the mob to infiltrate those. And in bars and strip clubs, too, or open areas.
Yeah, I would think in the adult,
real like borderline business.
In the adult industry, you have a lot of kind of secondary market opportunities. You know, like the strip clubs, like escort services. Assuming that any of these girls were that popular, you would, you know, and from the notes that Gary gave us, you have, you know, these are, you know, named pornography celebrities.
Yeah, I mean, we would fight over the who controls the girls. Like, back when websites first started, some of these girls were making $60,000 to $100,000 a month on their website. And I remember a legitimate guy, like, got into business, and he's like, well, you're charging this girl all this money, you're taking all this money from her. You know, I'm going to do it big different. We're going to take it over. And I go, dude, do you not understand? I mean, are you dense? I go, you think I'm going to let you take $120,000 from me? And he's like, well, you have no choice. She's going to want to move. And I go, we're going to break your head. It cost me like $3,000. You're done. At the end of you. You're not doing anything. He's like, And I go, you don't understand. Like, I'm going to leave. I'm going to go to Palm Springs, and someone's going to crack you in the head with a pipe. And that's the end of the problem. People are like, at first, they just didn't understand. Like, dude, no one's taking away a girl that brings me in that much money. No way. Not possible. And plus, my thing is I spread it with everybody. See, I'm just a cog in the wheel. I kick money to every single person around me. I make every single person around me have money. You can't be greedy. That's what keeps you alive. That's why I'm still here, is because I was a snake, but I paid everybody.
No, that's what's around. Important is paying. That's the only thing that's really important in that world, is if you make sure everybody gets their fair share, shall we say, their cut.
But aren't there people looking over your shoulder going, man, Kenji's making a bank. Like, they don't want to take over your racket?
Yeah, good luck. I mean, you know, hey, I totally recognize that people would want to, and guess what? That's why I'm 100%, you can't play in that game. You can't be half a gangster. I saw so many guys get hurt like this. You can't play to be a gangster, and you can't do it. If you say you're going to do something, you have to do it. And if you get in a confrontation, there is no, I'm going to call somebody. It's right there, right then, without doubt, without fail. That's it. Nothing else. And you have to retaliate right away. You have to make a statement. And I did really, really bad, horrible things to people because that was my life. You know, hey, they were in the business with me. So, you know, it doesn't make it right, but it's just that was the life. That's the life we chose.
It was how you kept people in line.
I figure everybody bought their ticket to the big show. And if you buy your ticket, then you're fair game.
Yeah. They're all adults, and they're in their free will. And no one forced them into it. No one forced you to do whatever you did. So that's what we did. But yeah, I made money from as many things as I could. I did the bookmaking, the Shylocking, the bookmaking, the pornography led me to other things. You know, guys would tell us about, like, you know, things, places to rob, and we, you know, bust open safes and steal them and get jewelry, get diamonds and cash. And that's, you know, I'm just a criminal. I'm a wise guy. That's what I did.
Yeah, living that life and across the board, you must have known, you must have been a fountain of knowledge of who was doing what in Orange County, and I suppose in Los Angeles County too. How organized was it there? It's such a huge, big, sprawling city. You could be operating as a fence in Orange County and nobody would know it. You know, over in Los Angeles County. So, I mean, how do you make these connections and get the word around and that kind of thing?
You would know it because the people in that, it's just a small world. You know, when you do big things, it's like a small world. And like everyone says, oh, the LA, you know, the LA family, it, at one point it was really big. I mean, in the Jimmy Fragnano days, about 60 people. When I was around them, about 20, 30 people. And then, you know, now it's pretty much dead. They just don't have the talent pool to pull from anymore. At the time, it was pretty well organized. And remember, each captain, like, you know, like Jimmy was a captain, like Palm Springs, Riverside, Orange County area. Mike Rizzi was down there, Orange County. You had a bunch of guys that lived in that area. You have a bunch of guys that live in L.A. and up in the valley and stuff. And other families worked there, but believe me, they paid Pete. Like everyone's like, oh no, Chicago ruled. No, they didn't. Those guys all, it's still, the people don't realize that the Cosa Nostra and the way it's set up is every family's equal. That's why they have a commission. That's why they have all that stuff, so they don't fight. Two families don't go head-to-head. I mean, we used to work with guys from Denver. I mean, people, I remember when I first told the FBI, I'm like, yeah, you know, they're extinct. I go, no, I mean, I hung out with this guy, Paulie. I mean, I know him. I know his cousin. We bought property in Vegas. They were going to make a casino there with us. And they couldn't even believe it. And they found out that I was telling the truth. I mean, that's how it was. Even though they were a small family and from Denver, we still recognized like him as the boss. Like he was introduced to me as the boss.
So these guys from the other cities, Cleveland and Denver and Kansas City, even Chicago, if L.A. and the L.A. Southern California area was a little bit wide open. Not that they could just go out and operate, but they could go out and operate as long as they checked in and made sure that the L.A. family was aware of what they were doing and got a little piece of the action. Would that be how it worked there?
Yeah. I mean, there was, like from New York, there was Joe Dente. He came out. He was a captain. And then there was what's his name, the record guy. He was a Gambino. I mean, there was a bunch of guys. The guys from Chicago there, other guys from Banana Family. Then the Tommy Gambino and the Gambino kids were there. There's a lot of Gambinos there.
Was a lot of that there, part of that draw just because it was Hollywood and that whole movie industry, whether it was porno or actual regular movie industry and celebrities?
Yeah, I mean it's that and like. They had guys from the Banana Family that were friends with movie stars, and like it's a better climate. They come out, it's relaxed. You're not under the thumb of Brooklyn guys. You know what I mean? Like your boss is not there. You're out of sight, out of mind. You send back money once in a while. It's an easy life.
Yeah, we talked.
That's how that is.
When we talked to Andrew DiNonato, he said he had to show up at that guy's clubhouse, and all of a sudden I've lost his name, but the capo that he worked under, and he said you had to show up there. Whenever he wanted you there, he wanted to know where you were in between. It was it's a pretty heavily structured life back east, and I could see where a young guy would want to get away from all that control.
Yeah, but in L.A., I was under the same thumb. Like when I was called, I had to go.
Yeah,
like, that's it. Like we had beepers back then, you know, and there was like I had to call back within 5 minutes. There was like didn't matter. I had to be there. If I was told to be where, they don't care. Your mom's sick, your girlfriend's, they don't care. Not a problem. You got to be there. So if you want to be part of it, that's it. I mean, I was told like to cut my hair too long, cut it. Yeah, cut it. Shave, wear a collared shirt. Like,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of rules.
Our boss here in Kansas City, here in Kansas City always, he would not allow people to wear beards and had to have, everybody had decent haircuts and they all kind of dressed almost like in a uniform. He wore Sansibel polyester slacks, and they all did. He wore a leather coat. They all wore leather coats. They almost looked like they had uniforms on.
Yeah. So we're pretty much the same thing. They told us. After my years there, I got, you know, I was in a lot of trouble. I was on probation or parole all the time since I was 13 years old till 38 years old. I've been in trouble my whole life, out on bond, you know, whatever, incarcerated. Never had a period. The longest period I had was 3 months. And then I was already had indictment. I just didn't know it yet.
Wow.
So I left in like the early 90s. I went down to Florida and I hung out with some Columbos. And I did pornography down there. And I just committed more crimes because they didn't know who I was. I had got a travel permission. I was working at a moving and storage place. And I actually wasn't working there. I just had a no-show job. I got a paper job. And from there, I went to... I started meeting more people and people from New York, and I met a lot of Columbos. That's how I got in contact with the Sonny Francis guys through guys in the pornography, a guy named Jerry Zimmerman that was close to Michael and Sonny, and he introduced me to all kinds of Columbos. I just like always liked those guys. And then I started traveling with the porn girls. I go to different cities and I used to meet all the people. And I started just branching out. I mean, I was always a traveling kind of guy, so I met like a lot of different people, a lot of different crews in different places, Pittsburgh, Rhode Island. You know, I just like would go different places and like meet with the local LCN guys.
You say traveling with the porn girls. Now, what does that mean exactly? Were you going around doing like
strip clubs,
strip clubs, or openings for the movies or something?
Yeah, they would go to strip. yeah, they would go to strip clubs to do, like, you know, they're called feature dancers. They would get paid to go. And so I would go with them and, like, you know, protect their money, protect them, and get paid for it. Easy life, especially when I'm on parole and I'm not supposed to be doing stuff. You know what I mean?
It's like something. You had a paper job somewhere else.
And it gave me permission to travel.
And I guess it's yeah. still going on. We just had Stormy Daniels, the famous Stormy Daniels of Donald Trump fame, just appeared at the local strip club here in Kansas City. So I guess they're still going around with trading off their porn star name and showing up at strip clubs.
Yep, that's what they do. It's never going to change, I'm sure.
I wonder if Donald Trump came in with her to protect her and collect her money for her.
Yeah, he's acting as her muscle.
We better shut up. We'll have a lot of listeners mad like at that. Us. Some people don't like us. People making fun of the president. But
they don't like us for other reasons, but not usually that one.
Anyhow, moving right along. So that's. I was wondering how you'd made that spinoff, that pivot to the
adult
New York,
industry?
No, the New York crime families. It sounds like it was because of your connections you made in porn, and they like investing their money in porn, and you were a money maker. You were an earner.
Yeah, and I was already there. I knew some of the guys, and then I used to go back and visit New York and, like, stay there a couple weeks a month, and then I was just committing crimes with those guys, and I liked it there because no one knew who I was in Brooklyn or in Manhattan. Like, I was an unknown face. You know what I mean? Like, no one had any idea who I was, only the people that I knew. So I could go do stuff, get away with it. Like, I could go wreck guys for them, you know, beat them, rob them, whatever. And we get the money, and then I would be gone. I'd get on a plane and go home, and no one would know. And so I got involved with the pump and dump with them that way, the stock fraud. I was just traveling back there all the time. I was thinking about moving there, and I remember I was on the road. I was in Rhode Island. I got a call from Vegas that said the FBI just dropped by someone's house, and they wanted to talk to me. And I was like, why would they go to that person's house? They just go to my business. I had a porn store. You know what I mean? Like, they arrested me there like a couple times. I mean, it's not like I, you know, why not? Why would they do that? I'm like, tell me the name and the guy. And they gave me the guy, and it was Charlie Maurer. I called Vegas, the actual switchboard of Vegas, to make sure that he was an FBI agent. And I talked to him, and then he said, hey, man, we just want to talk to you. And I go, well, listen, I figured I'm getting arrested. You know what I mean?
So yeah.
I'm like, hey, I'm gone. I'm gone for the next 3 weeks. I'll meet you guys back in L.A., you know, and I made a day with him. He's like, yeah, don't flake. So I figured at that point, I figured, okay, now I'm wanted. I was leaving to Canada at that point, and I was like, I better go read a different name. So I went to Toronto, Canada. And then I came back, and then on the way home, I decided I better go drive. So I drove through across the border instead, and then flew back to California. But then I called them on the day, and they said, yeah, meet us at this deli, Kaplan's Deli in Costa Mesa. So I figured I was getting arrested, so I just took off all my jewelry. I brought like $20, no cell phone, no nothing else, slip-on shoes, sweatshirt, a couple shirts underneath, you know, two pairs of socks. I went in. And they met me outside the deli, two guys, FBI agents. They showed me their badges, and they were like, hey, man, do you have any weapons on you? I'm like, no. And I just put my hands up. They searched me, and they're like, hey, you're not getting arrested, but don't get shocked when you go in there. And I go, okay. So I went into this thing, and I turned into this private, like, room, and there was about eight FBI agents plus the two behind me. They said, whoa. I go, whoa. And they go, no, relax. You're not getting arrested.
So I'm curious
I sat
now.
Down with them. So I go, okay. So I sat down, and they're like, hey, man, we follow you all the time. You do this, you do that. You don't drink. You don't do any of this stuff. These other guys do. You know, you do realize you could be a millionaire if you just had a regular job. If you just worked garbage or something, you would already own the place.
Yeah.
And I go, oh, yeah, whatever. And then they start saying, listen, you know, you got to think about it. We're going to arrest you. You're going to end up in prison for the rest of your life, or you're going to end up dead. That's just life. That's the matter of fact. And at this point, I was already thinking about how I'm going to get out because, like I said, I had already been involved and I had done so much and been in so much trouble through my whole life, paid so much money for bail and lawyers and everything. And I could see that it was ending and it was going nowhere. And I was getting older. I was already in my 30s. And I said, now I don't want to be a rat on my friends. And they're like, listen, we don't even care about L.A. We just care about all the places that you travel. Care about New York, and we want intelligence. And I'm like, well, what do I get out of it? They're like, the only thing you're going to get out of this is a fresh start. That's it. And I go, a fresh start. And they're like, yep, start over. You're born again. And I go, I'm in. Made a decision right there. It was the best decision of my life. Actually, the turning point of my life. That second, I said, yes.
Interesting.
And then they said, you want to talk to anyone about it? And I'm like, and I said, no, absolutely no, nobody. They're like, you're sure? And I go, I'm positive. And then I said, one thing I said to him, I remember this. I remember clearly. How long do you think this will last? And they said, 6 months, a year tops. And I said, okay, I'm in. That was it. It didn't last just 6 months. It lasted 8 years. But that's when they, right after that, they gave me the code name Breakshot. Only the people in L.A., my handlers, knew who I was.
So and, you were, Kenji, you were under 8 years?
8 years I wore one.
Wow. I didn't really realize that. That's amazing. And I guess you all up and down the East Coast, but not in L.A.
I didn't get any L.A. guys, but I got some New York guys in L.A.
Okay.
I wore a wire against some people that were there. You know what I mean? That were traveling and stuff like that or had things in L.A. But I never did anything against L.A. family or anybody.
But in order to, for one question.
It was,
sorry. What year was that at Kaplan's Deli?
1996.
96.
Here's the deal. Here's what happened. So I thought I was off parole then. I was off parole. But I thought I was, like, free. You know, that was the only time since I wasn't on bail or parole or probation or in custody since I was 13 years old. 3 months. And I already had an indictment coming for mail fraud, which I probably would have beat it. I could probably beat it or, you know, get another parole, nothing again. I didn't realize it. It was in Vegas for Operation Thin Crest and Operation Button Down when they killed Herbie Blitzstein, which they didn't kill. Cosa Nostra didn't kill Herbie Blitzstein. That's like made up. It was a bunch of other guys.
Oh, yeah. So
close to some informants.
Yeah, we need to do that story on the podcast here. That's the Mickey Mouse Mafia. That's a pretty good story.
What was that operation again?
Operation Button Down and Operation Thin Crest. That was the FBI's... the two operations that they went against us.
What were they? How were the names connected
Vegas,
to the
Las Vegas.
Or Vegas? Why did they call them those names? I'm always interested. Like we had Operation Strawman in Kansas City, and that was finding the skim because they used strawmen to run the casinos and help them skim the money.
I think Operation Button Down was a nationwide one where they're going after all the people because Cosa Nostra was trying to like regroup again. So they're like, you know, getting the button, you know, buttoning down, getting the button men. And I think the Operation Thin Crest, because I guess some of the guys may have been in a pizza parlor or something like that.
Okay.
I'm not sure, but they gave me my code name, Breakshot, which is the opening of a pool game. I started traveling around. I was giving them information. They started liking that I was in New York. I started giving them information about New York. So they handed me off to members of the Colombo squad, C-38, in New York. And New York was really interested in their construction fraud and some of the pump and dump stuff and down on Wall Street. And so I immediately started wearing a wire. And it's just I had to get permission to transfer there. So Jimmy Cacci was in custody then, and they reached out to Carmike Persico, Snake, and then he reached out to Jimmy Cacci. And then they gave him permission, and I got permission to move to New York. And then I was in Teddy Persico's crew. Teddy Persico Jr. Is his nephew, and he's the son of Carmine's brother, Teddy Persico Sr. He's a made guy, but he was doing like 25 years for cocaine, for selling cocaine. And so he wasn't even out on the street. I just worked for him, and I wasn't supposed to actually ever, I thought the operation would be over before Teddy got out. So I just would hang out with his family and his friends, his close friends, and I worked for with a bunch of guys that had businesses that he had parts of. And then while I was there, I already moved there. I was living in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. One day, they changed the Rockefeller laws, and Teddy qualified to get out immediately. And they told me that they were going to pick him up, and they wanted me to get a Ranger ride home, so I got a porn star go with them, pick it up. So we met the limo.
It's like a movie,
$1,000.
Yeah.
I got a watch. Yeah.
What porn star?
I got a watch. I had a Cartier watch and a change of clothes and some new shoes for him. And we met him at the gate. So that's how that happened.
Cool.
Can you say which porn star?
From that.
Can you say which porn star?
Yeah. Dayton Rains. Yeah. Dayton Rains.
Hey, Kenji, so, before we go any further, I think you would you explain pump and dump a little bit? I know what it is. There'll be a lot of people out there that won't quite understand what pump and dump is. And I know they did a Sopranos on this, so a lot of people kind of understand it. Can you explain to us what pump and dump is?
Okay, well, usually what it is they would they would get companies that are listed on the exchange. So usually they would do a reverse merger, which is they take a company that is not on the exchange and they merge it with one of these shell corporations that already has a listing, and it has some assets. We did like a construction company, a little restaurant chain. They did seltzer water. They did vitamin water, like all kinds of stuff, like gyms. I mean, whatever you can talk people into, and you reverse merger it, and it's really, there's nothing coming in, there's no revenue, but you make it look like it. So then what we would do is we would bribe all these they're like little phone rooms, like on Boiler Room, where they call up and they sell stock. And you're not supposed to do that. You give them a spiff. So you give them like, so if they sell this penny stock and they sell $5 worth, we'd give them $2.50. Just to cut it down and make this easy, I'd give them $2.50 per thing that they sold. So at the end of the week, I'd pay them in cash. Like I'd pay $50,000 to a broker that sold like $300,000, $200,000 of stock. And with all this movement, all the sales, the prices would go up. And then we would dump it all at one time, the people in the know, and then it would collapse. And then so pump it up and then dump the stock real quick. You know, and I had stock in all different kinds of different companies, like Touch Vision and like all these companies, construction companies and stuff. And then someone would call me and they'd say, get rid of it. And then I'd have my straw person sell that stock for me and then get me the cash out. And then the next day it would go from like, just say like $2.80 to 3 cents or less than a dollar, you know, less than a cent even.
I think I lost a shitload of money on something like that once. I did lose a little bit of money on a little medical software company that I thought was going to be the next coming thing, and everything I could find out looked like it was going to be rolling, and I put money in. Next thing I know, it's done. It's like, you know, it's out of business. Probably the same kind of a thing. So yeah. What about the construction? You talked about construction. Aaron, yeah. You got a question.
Well, my question was really this, because at this point, were you not wearing the wire and operating under the guide, if you will, of the FBI, but still, you were an earner?
Right, but the rule was this, no violence at all, and I used to turn in the money, so the money I made for bookmaking and everything, I turn in. I got to keep money enough to pay, like, expenses and stuff at the beginning, and I had money coming in from my porn store, but the bulk of the money, I turned it. I wasn't Shylocking anymore at that point because, you know, obviously I can't collect the money. So I would just slowly, surely calling in my loans and getting my money and then not putting any more out on the street.
So a lot of this,
I wasn't allowed to keep any of the money from.
Like, you may not have been really involved with the pump and dump, but you knew about it, so you could then let them know about it. You couldn't really get too far involved in something that was cheating people out of money or taking the risk of hurting anybody.
I was never like a broker. I just got money from the people that merged and everything. I would get stock, so I would just turn it to the FBI. Like, I had to go talk to the U.S. attorney a bunch of times, and they would okay me to do certain things, and then I would just turn it in. I didn't participate in it. Like, I was never like one of the guys who like started that. I would just get money from that.
Okay, I got you. Yeah. Go ahead, Aaron.
Well, because I
kept doing it. I
would think that you have to, because their expectation is you come out from Orange County and you're doing this work for them, and you're an earner. You're generating revenue for them, and how could you continue to have a relationship where you're that intimate that you could get information on their activities without continuing to kind of participate?
Yeah, well, I did participate like I always did, but I gave everyone their share of money, and I just turned in my share to the FBI. Because you remember, like, I'm not actually stealing stock. They would give me stock for being part of the business. Or I got money from the porn people, and which is not illegal money, and I would use that to break up with people. I had money from the bookmaking, which I can continue doing, and I would give that out, and everyone would get their cut. The Columbos wanted me to even run one of their bigger bookmaking operations, even when I was there. And the FBI told me to turn it down only because it would constrain me and make me more stuck in one little area. They weren't really that much interested in gambling.
Yeah, interesting.
They
by
wanted
that
me
point,
to work more towards the construction people.
Yeah, by that point in time, gambling was, you know, there was casinos all over the United States, and there's the FBI has put less and less emphasis on sports gambling. Now, you mentioned the construction business. Yeah. Now, I'm curious about, you always hear about the mob, and especially in Manhattan, and all the construction projects, and how did they, what were some examples of how they made money out of that?
Well, just like the World Trade Center project, I went with a guy, and we went to the Deutsche Bank building, and it's 42 stories, and it was like one of the last buildings. They went up there, and they made a bid on it. They were going to do it, and they were going to steal $7 million of the steel out of it, okay? They were supposed to recycle it. They were just going to steal it. They control all the carting, like even, you know, the garbage, but also the dumping. So they would take like concrete, they're supposed to recycle the asphalt and then dump it in New Jersey. They would haul off the stuff. They would break down buildings. I was in the Bronx when they took down a building in the middle of the day in probably one of the most densely populated areas without really permission. They just start demolishing it. And then by the time it's down, it's down. Asbestos, whatever. It doesn't matter. But that's, they control all the unions, everything. I mean, I was around them. And that's all they would do. And they would have all these. I went to the Jersey place when they were like dumping stuff, and it just, they'd stack up the trucks. One truck after another would go from New York, and then dump, and then they'd come back. And that, they do that all the time. They have all this trucking. They have all the construction union, everything. And the cement, they control it all. And now they get foreigners. They get other people to work for them. They get like, oh, Chinese, Pakistanis, everything. And those guys are front guys, so there's not an Italian name on it.
Interesting. That's I always heard the Sopranos. Again, I hate to go back to, but the Sopranos based on so many real life things, and they had the big waste disposal business, and would intimidate anybody else that had any kind of a trash route into either being part of their business or just walking away. They even on that show, they even showed a guy that wanted to get a whole bunch of business, tree trimming business. And so they beat up the guy that was already had the business. I mean, that's right out of the mob playbook, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what they do. That's exactly what they do. They make a monopoly out of it. And they just make it impossible for anyone else to make any money. Then they could raise the price. They can do whatever they want.
I mean, so from 96 to 2004, weren't you like going back to the FBI going, hey, what happened to six months?
Yeah, but I kept saying that. I wanted to quit so many times. Like, I wanted to. And so I only had to stay in New York three weeks out of the month. And then 1 week a month, they would fly me back to California. And then I could just relax and, you know, take it easy. And that's what I would do. I would travel.
Well, that's a stress-filled life.
The guys I had to leave.
That wouldn't
change. Yeah, it took a big toll on me. I mean, I was like, you know. It was crazy, man. It was crazy living in Brooklyn. They finally gave me permission to move to Manhattan. So I moved to Union Square so I didn't have to be like living in Bay Ridge, like under the thumb. I still had to show up every day. But I mean, at least I didn't live by them. What happened is Teddy got out of prison. We did the porn star thing. And then he started wondering why everyone else had more money than him. And I was over it. So one time I was at his house and he's like, you know, do you think I'm getting robbed? I'm like, Teddy, what do you have? He's like, well, I got a new car. I'm like, first of all, we all pitched in for the truck. It was like 40 grand. Your Mercedes is leased. You don't own it. No, it's mine. I go, no, it's not. It's leased through this company. And he's like, well, then I go, look it. How many houses do you own? He goes, well, I got an apartment. I go, yeah, but you don't own it. This other guy owns like five houses. The other guy owns, he goes, well, I own these parking lots. I go, you don't own the parking lots. They give you money from the parking lots. The parking lots are in their name. They're getting equity from this. They're giving you pennies. Like, yeah, they get $2,000 a week, but they're gaining equity in the property. The value is going up. The truck yard, everything. I go, you don't own it. It's in someone else's name. You don't own the trucks. He's like, well, you know, and I told him how much I was making from the bookmaking and some other thing, and he couldn't believe it. So he's like, I think I'm getting ripped off. So he started questioning everybody, and they started getting mad at me. One day, he had a beef with someone else, he had a beef with another Colombo named Craig Marino, who in the Colombo family war, they had a civil war, went against his family, and they tried to kill his dad and his uncle, and we had a beef against Craig, and he flipped out. So we were eating. I was with Teddy Persico Jr. and Eddie Garofalo, and we were at a restaurant eating in Brooklyn. And they said, "Hey, come on, I'll drive you home." So I got to my house, and I got out, and I was walking to the front door, and Teddy yells out the window, "Get back in the car. We got to go deal with something." And at that point, I was like, "But I'm in the back, so I was good. I was good. I wasn't sitting in the front of the car. I was in the back of the car." So we started driving, and he started calling on the phone. He called his brother, and he's like, "I need my gear. Get the gear." And get like their cousin. He started naming some people. He was, "Get him and meet you at Ma's house." And then he turns around. He goes, "We're going to deal with Craig." And he goes, "You got a problem with that?" And I go, "Nope." And I was wearing the wire, so it was rolling. I had it in the watch and in my belt buckle, MP3 player. It was rolling. And he's like, "We're going to deal with this." And so he goes, "We're going to go to my mother's house." And then he tried to get the guy to come to his mother's house to the block, on that block, and they're going to ambush him, but he wouldn't. So when we got to his mother's house, his brother came over and brought the guns. They started divvying them up, and they had a box. And it came down, there was one or two left, but there was no bullets for it. And they said, "Well, just take it." I go, "I don't want to. It's not worth it. I'm not going to carry it." Really? And he's like, "Can't you make one of the bullets fit?" I go, "No, man, I can't. I can't. You have 357, it's the 38. It just won't work." And so they're like, "Okay, you got your knife?" And I go, "Yeah." And they're like, "Okay." Then his brother goes, "Hey, Teddy, we don't have any gloves, and the bullets are dirty." He goes, "Oh my God, what kind of gangster are you bringing?" Like, he flipped out. He's like, you brought dirty bullets. You don't even be clean. What an idiot!" And then he goes, "Okay, Frankie, you drive. Carmine, you take off your socks. You clean." He drives, and he goes, "We're going to meet him outside this thing. You're going to be across the street from the restaurant." He goes, "I'm going to take the kid down by the water. I'm going to deal with it. And Kenji, You're gonna. If anyone comes running back towards you, you're gonna take care of it with your knife." And I go, "Okay." And then Teddy turns around. Eddie Garofalo looks at me and he goes, "Duck!" Like, if they're shooting, duck, because they're like notoriously bad shots, right?
Yeah.
So we're in the car. We're driving back to Brooklyn, and we're driving to Brooklyn. And he's like, he's going crazy, and he's like, "Hey, man, you're being so quiet." I'm like, "Yeah, this is the way I deal with things. Yeah. I'm like, don't worry about me. I'm good. I'm just quiet. Actually, my wire was running, so, you know,
yeah,
had to be quiet." And he's like telling me like that Craig's a mate guy and everything, and we're going to deal with it. As we come over this little hill, we come over the rise in the restaurant, we're going to do the hit. Next door, there is an NYPD car, a big hook and ladder, and a paramedic, and they're wheeling a dude out on the stretcher. and Teddy's like, "Oh my God, we didn't even do anything and the cops are already here." I'm thinking in my mind, really, I'm like, this, the FBI is like really listening to me. Like, you know, wow, they set this up. So we get there, because I'm not supposed to commit any violence, and I couldn't call anyone, obviously. You know what I mean? I'm stuck with these guys. This is happening like minute by minute. So we get there, and Teddy goes, "I'm going to take the kid down with the water. I'm just going to berate him a little bit." And he goes, "If anything pops off, you be ready, but tell my brother it's off." I'm sitting there by the restaurant. Teddy's talking to the guy. And I look over, and I see his retarded brother and this other kid, Frankie, with socks on their hands, sitting across the street. And I run over there, and I go, "Hey, man, it's off."
Oh, God.
And he goes, "Nope, we're doing it." He didn't tell us. And I go, "No, it's off. There's cops here." And he goes, "No, we're told to do it." I go, "You're not doing it." Finally, I see Teddy's brother, Danny, and I tell Danny, and he goes, "Oh, I'll deal with it." He gets him to leave. Teddy comes back, and he goes, "I think I squared it with Craig. He's got a problem with you, but if anything happens, just don't turn your back on him ever."
Oh,
and
God.
I said, "Okay."
Yeah, okay.
And I go, "That's not really good, because Craig's known as a shooter. You know what I mean? He's like he's a murderer. So, and he has killed a number of people." At that point, I was like, "Oh." Right after that, I had a falling out with this other guy, Manny. I got in a fight with him in a diner, and I told him I'd punch him in the face and knock out his teeth, knock him out. The FBI decided that it was over. They had bugged a meeting with guys, decided that they were going to kill me. So,
oh yeah,
they
time to pull you out.
Yeah, that was pretty much it.
Well, at least good thing they were listening.
So I flew to Canada.
Now, Kenji, I don't think they were.
Yeah,
they weren't listening. They aren't the ones that called that hook and ladder and that New York City copper over there. I don't think they were listening to you that day, because if you had a recorder on your body, I doubt if they were listening to you. They'll listen later on. See, you just got lucky that day.
You know what? I used to think I was the luckiest person. That actually wasn't luck, and they weren't listening.
Yeah.
That's like, I'm telling you, that was like part of God. That was part of God watching out for me.
Yeah, I guess
like,
so.
That's part of what I'm talking about. It's like
there was a bigger plan for you.
That was it. That was the change, right? And so I ended up going to Canada, and I spent a couple weeks up there. They flew me to DC. I got debriefed, and they kept my phone on, because they didn't want anyone to know that I had already flipped.
Yeah.
So people were calling, looking for me, and then it went from being nice and then trying to find out where I was to, like, threatening me. I just kept recording, you know, kept talking to people, kept recording, and finally it came out, and they arrested everybody. They arrested Teddy and all his brothers and a bunch of other guys. Then, you know, I was already gone. I was hidden in the protection program. I was gone. They ended up pleading guilty, but then it led to a bunch of other guys that started wearing a wire. So they ended up getting Michael Persico, the good brother. They ended up getting Teddy again. They ended up getting Eddie and Eddie's wife, Alicia Garofalo, who was on that Mob Wife show, and everyone. So all that came from my investigation.
Interesting, interesting.
That's,
you ought to speak to the big change that came in your life, I think, personally. Let's talk about that a little bit, if you don't mind. And how you came to that place,
yeah.
And I have another question along with those lines is you were put in witness protection in the official WITSEC, as they call it, and then you came back out. So I'd like for you to speak to that just a little bit.
Okay, I left after 18 months because it wasn't for me. I just wasn't interested in that, and I could take care of myself, so I just got out of it, and I moved to California, and I just started writing, and I ended up writing my book, and I started writing screenplays. I worked in L.A. as a trainer, and when I got out, I made a promise to myself in the 90s that I would never commit another crime and I was done with this life, and so I got over the life. I said, okay, I'm done, and I said to myself, I'm just going to be a good person, and that kind of never worked out for me. I was still trying to be a mop that get all the money and still live that life, but not be a criminal. And I was still driven by money. And so from 2005 to about 2013, then I was trying to be like, you know, just be a good person and like try to do the right thing and have good karma. And that thing didn't work out with me. And the guys just kept talking to me. And one guy told me, you know, you're a real spiritual guy. Have you ever thought about Jesus Christ? And another guy sent me a Bible, like, in the same week. And I just told my my wife, I said, you know, I think I want to go to church. And I was not in trouble. I was out of it, way gone. And I decided to go to church. And I was really, really scared. I was like, man, I haven't been in since I was 30 years. And I was real scared, and I remember, like, my heart was beating fast. I was, like, sweating my underarms. I went to church, and I kept thinking, everyone's going to think I'm a fraud because I don't belong there. And once we started singing and everything, it all came back to me, and I just felt like this full, like, you know, and, like, I knew that I wasn't that lonely person anymore, and I wasn't that chip on my shoulder. I just felt like I was relieved. And that my whole life changed right then. And ever since then, I've just, I started going to church. I started doing Bible study. I started doing stuff with the church and just trying to do the best that I can, try to live a Christian life. And that's how I am. And that's where I ended up. So,
well, that's great. Yeah. Now, you run a gym now? Is that?
You know, I just want to have a relationship with God.
Yeah.
But you're...
Yeah. I own a gym. I trained Parkinson's boxers. It's called Rock City Boxing. I use my skill to train them and help them. It helps them a lot. It's a nationwide program. And I've seen great changes in people, and I try to help out anybody as much as we can. So that's part of, like, my mission, actually, is to do that and get people right with their health.
You're kind of, that's your way of making amends with the world that you took and took and took from. Now you're giving back, it sounds like.
Yeah. So this is all I'm trying to do. And like you just found out, I just came back from Israel. I mean, I got baptized in the Jordan River. Amazing.
I saw that picture. I saw that picture on Instagram. That was, folks, you need to go out to Kenji's Instagram. His Instagram is at KENJIOC. Or I think if you just type in Ken, K-E-N-J-I-G-A-L-L-O, you'll find Kenji's Instagram. He's got some great pictures from his touring around through Israel. And you and your dog, too. I see you spend a lot of time with your dog.
Yeah.
And then you have another Instagram that
I have that.
Is Better Living?
Yeah, I have
Better
Live
Lives.
Ahead. I have BetterLiveLives.com, too, is another one that I do.
And an Instagram at Better Lived Lives also.
Yes.
Yeah. And your dogs?
And my dogs, Henry and Phoenix. Those are my two dogs.
Well, Kenji, this has been quite a story. This is you live one heck of a life. It's you lived about four or five lives, you maybe seven or eight. You may only have one or two left, so you better keep doing the right thing and protect that last one you got left. You may have used all the rest of them up if you believe in that nine lives of a cat, dude.
I'm doing the right thing. I'm living right.
Good for you. And then your book that you have is out. It's called Breakshot, A Life in the 21st Century Mafia. And where can people find that?
It's available on Amazon and Kindle and paperback.
All right. And I'll put a link. I'll put a link up to it in the show notes.
I was going to say there's a couple of versions of it. There's a hardback. There's a paperback from Simon Schuster. And then there's a new trade paperback. The trade paperback has new stuff in it, like a couple, like a new chapter. And the Kindle version is the same as that. So,
okay. You got anything on the future? In the future, coming up, any movies? Nobody's ever made a movie about your life.
No.
Has anybody been optioned as a screenplay? Is that on the horizon at all?
Well, we optioned it to Fox. I optioned it to the guys who made Maze Runner. It's off now. I'm doing another book, a Christian book. It'll probably be out like by the end of the year. It's done. I'm just finishing up the editing, working with the guy. I'm gonna start doing Christian radio, Christian podcast next.
Oh, okay.
So
yeah, you'd be good on a podcast.
That's where I'm at. Yep. So that's what I'm gonna do.
Oh, I just gonna. So the guys from Maze Runner are at Fox, and they've optioned the book, and it's just kind of in development to become a movie.
Not anymore. Now it's mine again. Oh, and I'm just going to.
The option expired.
I'm waiting until my next book comes out. Yeah,
you know, actually, those kinds of books. In a way, there's been plenty of movies made about the life. You know, you could make a movie. And I think it would be interesting about shorten up your life a little bit, and then show your change in your life and your conversion, and then your life afterwards a little bit too. That might be a little bit different twist on the whole thing.
That's what I'm really interested in doing. I'm waiting. That's
good.
Where I want to go.
That would make a really great Christian movie
about another gangster.
Yeah, Aaron said that'd make
a
good
really
Christian
care about
movie.
Glorifying that part of my life.
Really, that's become. I kind of follow that stuff a little bit, and that really has become a viable genre that will, sell out theaters, because there's a kind of a built-in audience. Once the word starts going around, people in that community will all show up to see your movie.
Right. Well, and it's not
That's my ultimate goal, and that's what I would be happy with. So.
Yeah, and it's a true story, and so that's, I think, what makes it great in and of itself, not just the criminal element, but just kind of your personal conversion and faith and the ability to change your own life for the better, and then take that and impact other people's lives by sharing your story.
Yeah, that'll be great. I'm looking forward to it. We'll keep following you, Kenji, and...
We'll see you in Vegas.
And maybe we'll see you in Vegas. And we see that movie starting to come out, we'll definitely be pumping that up. And when your book comes out, I follow you on Instagram, so you'll be putting something up about that when your next book comes out, and we'll make sure that gets some mention, okay?
Well, maybe we can talk with him about that book.
Yeah, we could. Yeah, right. Actually, we could just do another show when that book is ready to be released. All right, Kenji, it's good talking to you.
Me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
No, thank you.
All right, good talking.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, Aaron, that is quite a story. It's a little bit different ending than the other mob guys we've had on here. That guy he's impressive. I met him out there, and he's quiet. You can tell he's tougher than nails, but he's quiet and polite and kind and generous. He's kind of formed a ongoing friendship and support group with Frank Calabrese and Andrew DiDonato. Calabrese kind of mentioned it in passing. I know that these guys still talk to each other all the time and kind of buck each other up when they get a little bit down, because they really have a unique place in life right now. They have been involved with mob people, and they have testified. They have worn wires. They have done all the things that'll get you killed, and they've come back out. They're not in the witness protection program. They're out there if you want to find them. Be easy enough to find any one of the three. But so there's a certain tension that's added to that, to their lives, but they stick together. I know that, even though they're all in different cities, I believe, but they stick together and support each other. Pretty interesting stories.
That was amazing, actually. That's why I'm surprised that it's somebody hasn't optioned it out and it's a movie.
I know.
Or they're developing it as a movie, because...
You know, there's 7 million stories in the Naked City. You never know on when a movie's going to get made or it isn't.
I'm trying to think of who could play the part of Kenji.
Yeah.
Paul Kim,
our friend Paul Kim out there. He's
I didn't want to say it when Kenji was on the air. He's Japanese-American, and I think Paul is Korean-American.
Korean-American, yeah. Well, Paul could play him. I think Kenji would probably be the best guy to play himself, actually.
Right.
I think he could probably do it.
That would be a great way to kind of do the narrative from the story, as you start kind of, you know, you tease the front end of, here's this guy,
yeah,
and he's Christian, and you know, and then you go back to his youth, where here's this young kid running the streets and riding his bike and carrying $50,000 in a backpack.
Really doing
really clean-cut kid, you know, and that's one of the things I don't think we ever quite delved into when we talked with him, is that he really didn't look the role of the...
Oh, I know, we didn't. You're right. That was some of the things I read about that. The kid running around here with kilos of cocaine and on a bicycle, but he had such a... I mean, you could have had him here for the next 2 or 3 hours and going into the weeds, into the details, and that'd been a heck of a story.
I think he said he had an hour, and we got more than that out
of
him.
Yeah, we did. We got a little over an hour.
I should say you folks got more than that out of him.
Yeah, you guys. We all got more than an hour out of him. It was really entertaining for me. You know, I think, you know, we serve to entertain people with mob stories and true crime stories, but I get entertained myself. How about you, Aaron?
You know, it's that there's those high points in my life that I've had over the years. And certainly this doing this with you, Gary, is one of those, and it seems like week after week, month after month, now year after year, it just gets better. Like, we just keep talking, you know, like it was 2 weeks ago when we had, we talked with David Shanks in the studio.
Right.
And Bill Owsley came in that afternoon beforehand, and we had talked to him. Right, and of course Andrew DiDonato and Frank Calabrese Jr., you know, just stacking up on top of the fact that we've talked with, you know, Martin McNally.
Yeah, speaking of Martin, I've got a lady that's desperately trying to ask him a question. It's kind of interesting. Her father disappeared, and he was a counterfeiter back in the 70s, and Martin mentioned a guy that he knew that got him a false or a birth certificate, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy was a counterfeiter. It was a great counterfeiter. And this lady's trying to figure out if that could have been her father. So I'm trying to hook them up. He doesn't really want to talk about him. I'll give up the name. Where that stands now is that I sent him the information as to why she wanted to know the name of that counterfeiter. So I'll leave that back in his court now. Pretty interesting. And that night,
he listens to the podcast, so he might have.
Yeah.
He didn't always have to email him. You could just talk it on the episode and go, Martin, if you're listening to this, because
really,
we know
Martin,
you do.
Are you
Thank
listening?
You. Yeah. Again, but.
I found another, speaking of him, I found a guy, and we'll do doing a phone interview with him. He was a prisoner. I mean, he was a prison guard. He was a prison guard at Merriam Prison while Martin was in the prison, and he remembers him and knows a lot of stories about him. So we'll be getting him on. He was there when John Gotti got beat up by another inmate. He's got a ton of stories.
I wonder, was he there when Martin and Trapnell?
Oh yeah, he was there when they got caught in their little
trying to escape.
Yes, he was there.
That would be great.
Yeah, he's going to be a good one. I got to call him. I told him I'd get hold of him this next week, folks. We're about to wind down here. Before I do the public service announcement and Aaron does a little shameless self-promotion for us and in our podcast, my movies and all that, don't forget, this will be coming out before. Aaron and I will be in Las Vegas at the Plaza Hotel, which is in downtown Las Vegas, on Friday night, June the 15th. There'll be a reception at Goodman's. Oscar Goodman owns a restaurant in there at Goodman's Restaurant, kind of a meet and greet with several mob authors. Frank Culotta should be there. Larry Henry, who does for Newsbreaker, does the casino blog. And I think the guy from the, who is a friend of Larry's, Jeff Schumacher from the Mob Museum, who is the kind of the content developer at the Mob Museum, and several other mob authors should be there. We don't know exactly who yet. We're just trying to line them up now. And Saturday there'll be panel discussions and author readings from 9 until 1 o'clock at the Plaza. That night there'll be a reception and a speaker, and then you'll have about an hour to walk around the Mob Museum, all as part of your entrance fee for the we're going to call it, I think it's the Mob Authors Summit 2018, but I'm not sure yet. Sunday morning from 9 until 1, there'll be another set of panel discussions and mob authors talking. So we...
back at the Plaza Hotel.
Back at the Plaza Hotel. It's that whole weekend for $100. There's a... there'll be a code. When you look on Facebook. Look on my Facebook. Aaron and I both will be sharing this thing on Facebook and Instagram. We're going to create an event. There'll be a code that you can use to get a cut rate on the on your rooms at the Plaza Hotel. So we hope to see you out there.
Looking forward to it. That's really exciting.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Maybe Kenji will show up after he comes by. Comes
we'll
over from, you know, actually, because the reality is he could fly over from, if he's not in L.A.
He's not in L.A.
Oh.
He's in, he must be up in New York or somewhere. The pictures he's been putting, you know, we didn't ask him where he lives.
Yeah, maybe
we
shouldn't.
I don't like to do that, actually, myself. But I know the pictures he puts up shows that there's cold and it's snow, so I'm not sure where. He's in the northern hemisphere, shall we say, north of L.A., and not California, Northern California either. No. Anyhow.
That's a pretty cheap ticket there.
Yeah. If you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for rent or purchase on Amazon. And you're going to watch that and you're going to want to know more because there's more to know. And Gary is the man to tell you about it with his book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
It's a great read, and even better listen, because you've got to get the Kindle for another $1.99. You can actually listen to the words from the mouth of the men that did it. Hyperlinks to video transcriptions from the Argent case distilled down to the most salient points from the mouth of the men that did it. And then, of course, there's more to know, because this is a story that is never ending. The mob, which started here in Kansas City at the turn of the century, still here all across the United States. And what you want to be able to do is when you come to Kansas City, you want to go to those great notorious mob locations. And you can do that because Gary's got an app, the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can download the app and take your own turn-by-turn tour of notorious mob locations, homes, and events where crimes occurred in and around Kansas City.
And you can see pictures of what it looks like now and sometimes pictures of what it looked like back in the day. So,
and then you want to subscribe to our iTunes account and give us a review. If you love the podcast and you are Martin McNally or anybody else, give us a review. Give us 5 stars. And then please put a hit out on our donate button. As hard as we're working for you to give you this great content, we want to keep doing it. And we've just got a little bit of overhead. You just need to wet our beaks and then come see us in Las Vegas on June 15th, 16th, and 17th.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron.
Good night, folks.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.